Roll call, please.
Chair Perkins? Vice Chair Arascada?
Here.
Regent Boylan?
Here.
Regent Carvalho?
Here.
Regent McMichael?
Here.
Regent Moran? Here. You have a quorum.
Thank you. Is there any public comment in ELCO? Can they hear me? I'll take that as a no. Any public comment in Reno?
And there's none in Reno.
Thank you. Any public comment in Las Vegas? Thank you. And any video or mail-in comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have one online public comment submission from Sarah Quintana. Greetings, Chair Perkins and members of the ENCHI Cultural Diversity Committee. My name is Sarah Quintana, and I am currently the manager of CTE and early college dual credit programs at the College of Southern Nevada. I am writing to express concern regarding opposition I have received for CTE dual enrollment programming initiatives targeting Title I secondary schools with high minority populations. Troublingly, this demographic is currently underrepresented within dual credit programming. How can we close the achievement gap if impoverished students of color are not afforded the same opportunities as wealthy charter schools? My dual credit programs are differentiated by embedding site-specific scaffolding to meet the unique needs of the secondary students and staff. Additionally, the proposed program pathways typically culminate in a CTE industry-recognized credential of value with credits earned in real time. As many of Nevada's students are inundated with adult responsibilities, including the expectation to financially support their families, my programming creates opportunities for gainful employment immediately upon high school graduation. The state CTE / CTE college credit programs, however, awards a handful of credits requiring students to complete additional courses after high school before they may enter the industry. Moreover, the extensive state-mandated equipment lists present yet another barrier to access. The secondary model currently utilized does not support student achievement, workforce development, nor is it a best practice. As millions of dollars are paid into this program annually, it would behoove us to examine its efficacy by comparing total program investments to the ENCHI credits applied toward a credential of value or degree. I also recommend disaggregating the data to include information on sex, ethnicity, disability, income level, ELL identifiers, and rural versus urban locations. Thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Thank you. And with that, we'll move on to item number two, the minutes for acceptance. Do I hear a motion?
Motion to accept.
Second.
Thank you, Regent Michael, and the second was by Regent Boylan. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion passes. That brings us to number three, the chair's report. Actually, I'm going to take my time on the chair's report to introduce our allyship presentation. It is done by Dr. Sandra Cosgrove. Well, first let me say thank you to staff. They have been amazing in preparing this particular agenda, and they have heard my cries and calmed me down and made sure that this meeting can move forward in a positive fashion, so I appreciate that. Dr. Sandra Cosgrove came to Nevada and raised her family, and she's also an alum with her PhD from UNLV. She currently teaches at U.S. History and Native American History and Latin History Studies. She works with the CSN Women's Alliance to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion. The Women's Alliance offers programming, services, and advocacy for the institution's female-identifying students. She also serves on many boards, including past president of the League of Women Voters, the vice chair of the Nevada Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, wow, that was a mouthful, and City of Las Vegas Historic Preservation Commission, and also a member of ACLU and a board member of Nevada Women in Trades. Do you eat or sleep much, Sandra? Or Dr. Cosgrove? And currently she's the executive chair and director of the Board for Vote Nevada, which is a new civic engagement nonprofit that promotes civic participation, civil rights, with a specific focus on us Nevadans. So with that, ally presentation from Dr. Sandra Cosgrove.
Thank you very much. I do sleep between 2 and 4. And that's both morning and in the afternoon. I do the siesta. Call me Sandra, because whenever I come here, it's always have to remember when I'm stepping up that I'm not just talking to Carol or Laura, because I know you all. It's like, hi, friends. It's good to see you. And that's one of the things I really like about civic engagement in Nevada, is that most of the time when you're the person sitting at the commenting chair, you're talking to somebody that you probably had lunch with yesterday. And so I always feel really comfortable coming and talking to you all. I always tell other people to come. Obviously, we're kind of in pandemic conditions. But I agree we need to get more students. Regent Perkins was talking about that. Today, what I want to do, I'll say what I usually say to my students. I'm going to explain something to you that you already know. It's something that you just haven't thought about in this way, and that's allyship. And so let me see if I can use the clicker here. So before I talk about Dr. King and the March on Washington, let's do some common vocabulary. So vocabulary that I'm going to use that I want to make sure that we all kind of have the same meaning of in our heads. So in the United States, we have a democratic system of government. So democracy, fair competition of ideas. Our economic system, capitalism, fair competition of entrepreneurs. And so when you look at a lot of the systems that we have that run our society, competition is embedded in a lot of them. We like that. We like to have more people involved. We want to have more voices involved. We want to have more ideas involved. And then we want to see actually people, you know, argue it out. And using the kind of academic argument, not what we see on Twitter and Facebook, where people just scream at each other. But what we want to, you know, have two candidates that are going to run for office with really strong ideas, and we want to see them debate it out, and then we're going to pick one. Same thing with capitalism. We want somebody, if they've got a good or a service, we want somebody to compete so we get the best good or service. But the problem is that we're human beings. And so, you know, humans tend to, or we're organisms that really have to live in social groups to be able to survive. But boy, do we like to cheat. We always want to get a little bit ahead. We want to get a little bit more for us. We want to get a little bit more for our family. And that's why we end up having laws and rules and systems to make sure that we're all being honest and that we actually have fair competition. And so we do system analysis. And so this is something I know you all talk about a lot. I could probably give this presentation to the audit committee as well. System analysis to make sure that everything is fair. We've got, you know, level playing field, real good competition, and that the best ideas are actually going to win. But as a historian, I can tell you oftentimes that's not what happens because somebody was gaming the system. And so I want to frame this within what we always do every year on Dr. King's birthday and also on the anniversary of the March on Washington. We really like this quote. We really like his I Have a Dream quote because it's easy. Because we can all say, oh, well, I like you. I like your kids. Your kids can come over to my house. I don't see color. You know, we all like to say those things because, boy, that's super easy to do. And so we really like that quote. But any of you who know me on social media know on his birthday and on the anniversary of the March on Washington, you're actually going to see me posting his letter from the Birmingham jail. And that's something that happens before the March on Washington. And this is where Dr. King goes down to Alabama, and they were going to do some public protesting. There was going to be a strike. There was going to be all kinds of stuff that was going to kind of stir the pot a little bit. And his white moderate friends said to him, do you really have to do that? Is this really necessary now? Do you really have to talk about this thing? And so when he gets arrested and he's sitting in jail, he pens what becomes known as a letter from the Birmingham jail. And he says to them, you know what? On any given day, it's not the Klan that's my problem. On any given day, it's not the racist down the street that's my problem. It's my white moderate friends who are the problem. Because I say to you, it's the system you're benefiting from that's not fair. And it's not. I'm not able to get access to it. It's got discrimination embedded into it. And so if you actually believe what you say you believe when it comes to the I Have a Dream speech, then you're going to join with me to look at that system to make sure that it's fair, to make sure that there's a level playing field. And so when I talk about allyship, whether I'm talking to colleagues or friends or I'm on the radio or whatever I'm doing, I say, okay, if you want to really be an ally and you really want to talk about discrimination and systemic racism, are you willing to look at the system that benefits you and deconstruct it? Are you willing to put that on the table and have an audit done? or to have a system analysis done, or to have someone put it under the microscope. And a lot of times people will say, no. No, no, my system is fine. What's benefiting me is fine. And I see this a lot in education. We know we talk about we want to be there for the students. We talk about how we want the things to be better. But I see among my colleagues, as soon as we touch their system, no, we can't do that. My system's fine. And so it's important that when you're talking about allyship, you're also willing to put what's benefiting you on the table so that it can be examined and looked at and put under the microscope and have the audit done and have the report written about it. And if it comes down that it's not fair competition, that if there's something that's discriminatory that's built in, then being willing to say, if that's the case, then I'm willing to change. I'm absolutely willing to change. But unfortunately, I mean, one of the problems that we have in our society is everybody wants to protect the thing that's benefiting them, and they're not willing to put it on the table. And I know each one of you, this is the reason you want to be a regent, because you want to make sure our systems are actually working for our students. But it's always important to remember, when you get that gut feeling, this is my system and I don't want to change it, that allyship means you're willing to put it on the table. See, it's something that you already knew. Okay. That's all I have.
I guess I'll entertain questions.
Oh, see, you're like my students. I might have to call on people.
Go ahead. Regent Carvalho.
Thank you. Well, I don't have as much of a question as a comment and an appreciation for this agenda item. I think, just like you said, Sandra, that it's something we already know, but we have to be reminded of it sometimes. And I think bringing the idea of allyship to the center again is very important. And sometimes, like you said, the discussions are uncomfortable for many different people, but it's why we do what we do, like you said. So thank you for coming today. Thank you, Regent Perkins, for inviting Sandra.
And thank you, Regent Moran.
Yes, Professor, thank you for coming. Really appreciate your work and your dedication and whatnot. And it's funny you talk about doing well in school and having students and asking students questions. The interesting thing, real quickly, in less than a minute, my mother was sharing with me my first grade report card that she had pulled out, and in the category on the side there were all of these U's, and she said to me, one of them she kind of highlighted, and it says works well with others, and it says U. And I said, well, that means unbelievable, Mom. And she goes, no, look up at the symbols. It says actually unsatisfactory. But anyway, it made me think of that. Thank you for your hard work, and thanks for your time and effort. Really appreciate it. Continue the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Del Capo. I mean, Chair.
With Kelly Carroll. Thank you, Sandra. You're always inspiring. You're a tireless worker, and I really appreciate what you've brought to us this morning. And it begs the question, would you recommend the board have a seminar, a session? It's a public meeting, of course. We'd have to do everything properly with open meeting law, but to have a 4-hour, a 3-hour, 2-hour, 8-hour, what would you recommend just to... And I have to say, I've said this before. I mean, since I've been on the Board of Regents, this is my fifth year, my eyes have been opened. I came to my first meeting, I believe, was at College of Southern Nevada. And honestly, I didn't know a student even slept in a car because he couldn't afford housing. And that's 5 years ago. And now it's so common. Our students have food insecurity. They have housing insecurity. Transportation insecurity. At our ACCT conference in San Diego, we had a whole session on the pregnant young student, or any student, and the issues a pregnant student feels. So there's so many issues, and I'm a big believer in personal development and training, and just to make us better as a board, as better as individuals. And what would you recommend we do? Thank you.
Good question, because I know among faculty, when the issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion come up and we start talking about professional development, too often we say, oh, it's going to be a 4-hour seminar, and everybody rolls their eyes and they don't want to do it. I just did it in 3 slides. It's not that hard. It's what people already know. And so when we do things through the Women's Alliance, and Laura participates and Amy participates in those things, we get what's like 1 hour. You can give me 1 hour of your day. And people will give you 1 hour of the day. And it might mean we have to do 1 hour each month if we've got lots of topics or lots of things we want to talk about. But what I always say is you already know this. It's something you're already doing. You're just not thinking about it this way. As opposed to saying you're wrong or there's something completely different than you have to do. People are good-hearted. Maybe they just haven't thought about it in the way that we want to think about it. So I would recommend just starting out with 1 hour. And from there, conversations will get started, and then you may want to do more. But at the end of 1 hour, people might say, we're good. That's good then. You know me, I'm always about efficiency.
Thank you.
Okay.
Great question.
All right.
And anything else?
Oh,
do you have another question? Carol? Okay. I just saw hands going up in my peripheral. What would be like something that we could do like today that would promote allyship?
Listen more. And when I say listen, oftentimes people are like, sure, I was listening, but are you really hearing what the person has to say? Because what I find, and this is one of the reasons I end up showing up at a lot of meetings and going to lots of events, is I just show up and listen. Just sit in the back of the room and listen to what people are saying. And then if somebody says to me, oh, it's nice to see you. Well, what are you doing here? Why did you come today? I say, what do you need? What do you need from me? And then just listen. Because too often in academia, and I'm guilty of this too when you're an academic, is you want to show up and tell people what to do. Or you want to share your research with them, or you want to be the sage on the stage. So it's kind of difficult when you're used to being that way to just sit in the back of the room and listen deeply to what people are saying, even when it may be making you feel uncomfortable, and be willing to kind of think about what they're saying in a way that you can address it that's going to meet both of your needs.
That's a short order. Thank you very much. Are there any further questions from the board? And thank you.
Thank you. And I appreciate you all.
Same here. And so that takes us to item number 5, the INCHI Hispanic Serving Institutions Task Force, information only. What is it, Vice Provost?
Vice President.
Ooh, Vice President Coda. Thank you.
Good morning, Clarissa Coda. CSN Vice President for the North Las Vegas Campus and NCHI HSI Task Force. And I must say that I do appreciate my colleague, Dr. Sandra Cosgrove. I always learn something when I have the opportunity to hear her speak, and extremely motivational. That's why I love what we all do. So thank you this morning to Chair Perkins and the Regents, Chancellor Rose, Presidents, and colleagues, for allowing me to present on our collective work related to student success at our HSIs and emerging HSIs. So what a Hispanic serving institution is defined federally within Title V of the Higher Education Act. These are institutions of higher education with 25% or more undergraduate Hispanic full-time enrollment. What's interesting about this is that HSIs represent 17% of all higher education institutions. However, they are educating 67% of all Hispanic college students. In addition to that, there's a nuance as well. HSIs also enroll more African American students than all HBCUs collectively. They also enroll more American Indian students than all TCUs. In addition, they enroll 40% of all Asian American students. So when we think about the work that we are all doing, you can see the impact of looking at the interventions that are being made, not only for HSIs, but for all of these other populations that we serve. In 2018-2019, we had 539 HSIs within the United States and Puerto Rico and DC. That number is now up to 569. They are comprised of 2-year and 4-year institutions. But the important part of that is hopefully you can all see the competitive environment that we are all in, because upon being designated as an HSI, you are then eligible to compete for federal grants, which are highly competitive, and the field is only getting more competitive. Therefore, our relationships with our congressional delegates become more important so that they can go out and advocate, and your support all the way along means so much to how we can improve our service to our students. The HSI Task Force came about really by community stakeholders, mainly in Southern Nevada, asking for us to collectively approach how are we going to be serving our students as our institutions and state is changing. And so I'm very happy to say that through the support of the Board of Regents, the Chancellor's Office, and so forth, we were able to form an HSI task force among all institutions in the state so that we could approach our intervention system-wide and collaboratively, helping each other become HSI not only eligible and designated, but truly serving our students and sharing best practices amongst each other. So again, the benefits of our unified task force is also a result of all of the support that the Board of Regents have provided all along, the Chancellor's Office, institutional leadership across the state for supporting the work that we all do. Some of the benefits that really stand out, and hopefully I'd like to highlight, is the fact that Nevada is the only state to have a unified higher education HSI task force. We have the benefit of being able to be a two-year, four-year, R1 institutions all coming together around the same level of interventions. And this has caught the attention nationally. It has made us more competitive to bring best practices conferences to Nevada, therefore elevating the accessibility for our faculty, our staff, our students, administrators to attend such conferences. So two of them notably are mentioned there as far as the best practices that came along in 2017 and 2019. Another benefit is leveraging our partnerships and our memberships to these organizations within the HSI-MSI ecosystem. By us meeting on a monthly basis, we share our contacts, we share our partnerships, and that has also resulted in bringing and being invited to invite-only symposiums and research-based summits. Some of them were like, for example, the NSF Southwest STEM Conference in Arizona in 17. We also have the National Academy of Sciences, where our deans across all of our institutions, and she supported sending our deans to this invite-only symposium about increasing STEM accessibility for our minority populations. We also now have membership on the HACU, which is the Hispanic Associations of Colleges and Universities Board of Directors, with Dr. Zaragoza serving on that board, first time in Nevada. So this partnership really is helping accelerate the work that we are doing. And many times we find ourselves competing with states and institutions who have been HSIs for decades. And frankly, we've only been HSIs, one HSI in the state since 2015. So we are really helping each other get ahead faster. Another benefit is frequently discussing about grant writing and grants. Because with our Title V, Title III, NSF grants opportunities, by us coming together on a monthly basis, we talk about the possibility of partnerships, two plus two arrangements that we could be making, and then we take that back to our institutions and start building the collective and collaborative groups. And finally, by working with and through the systems office, we also provide recommendations to our government officials and our stakeholders to equate to better service to Nevada. And at this time, I really would like to thank the Systems Office under the leadership of Chancellor Rose, Vice Chancellor Brooks, General Counsel Yvonne Neverez-Goodson, for really jumping in and assisting and supporting the work that we are doing so that we can collectively present our recommendations to the stakeholders. I am very fortunate to work with colleagues from across the state, representing each of our institutions, including DRI, that come together for our HSI Task Force membership. I can tell you, every month, our colleagues come together willing to collaborate, bring their expertise, and many of you have participated in those meetings, which we welcome and we thank you. To give you a snapshot of the importance of what we do and the impact in numbers, so in 2019, we have approximately 110,000 students that NSHE serves. 32,000 approximately are Hispanic students, representing close to 30% overall. When you start looking at the graduation rates from the four-year institutions, the overall graduation rate is about 51%, and the Hispanic graduation rate is still slightly lower at 44, 45%, so more work needs to be done. Looking ahead and looking further into the years, which is what we've been doing all along, you see that by looking at the Nevada high school graduates, we know we're capturing about 42, 43% of the Nevada high school graduates that will enroll in one of our institutions. But this pipeline is only going to grow in terms of the diversity that we're going to see coming out of our K-12 systems. And so as of 2021, we have 43% of Nevada's K-12 student population Hispanic. And we can break it down and look at all of the demographics, but we know this. So it's so important of the work that we are doing. And I really want to commend the vision, starting with the NSHE and the Board of Regents and the Chancellor's Office, that back in 2014, when Nevada was reaching a 28% Hispanic demographic in Nevada, and we were the fifth largest percentage across the country, we were told, let's form an NSHE HSI task force to really look at this and prepare ourselves. And so in 2014, this task force was formed. And then as you can see through the timeline, it was really not only just hitting the numbers in the enrollment. The real essence of HSI is how we are serving. What interventions are we doing to really maximize the student success for the students we serve? That is really the essence. So preparing our institutions involves strategic planning at the highest level. And so every year subsequently from 2015, you can see that now CSN, Nevada State College, UNLV, TMCC, and WNC are now eligible HSIs. So we have five of our seven eligible institutions, with the other two, Great Basin as well as UNR, right on the cusp. So as we kind of look at each of our institutions very quickly, CSN in 2015 became the first HSI in Nevada. Currently, we are now at 36%. We are very glad to report that we now have a successful Title V with $2.8 million grant that came to help students get through Gateway Math. Also, through the strategic planning and embedding HSI principles, we now have a fully staffed Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion and other interventions that help to provide a welcoming environment to our Hispanic students. And most notably, it's also helping our student success by closing the gap, the equity gap, in our math and English completion for Hispanic students. Great Basin is at 23% Hispanic enrollment. And so they are getting very close to the 25% threshold to becoming an HSI. So they are actively participating on our task force, and we are helping them as well to prepare for that. Nevada State College was the first institution to have received a Title V in 2017, and they now have a subsequent Title V grant that they received in 2020. They currently are at 41% Hispanic, and then have a lot of other interventions, and most notably, they also are very forward-thinking with their ANAPESI interventions. Truckee Meadows Community College is at 34% Latinx student enrollment. They have an active HSI task force. And so they are active participants on a monthly basis for all of our interventions and very collaborative in our partnerships. UNLV. UNLV is currently a 30% Hispanic, and they have an active HSI-MSI task force, and they were the first four-year institution to become an HSI. And then within their Academic Multicultural Resource Center, they now have the Undocumented Student Program, which is considered somewhat of a best practice throughout the state, and many of us are working on those issues as well. UNR, currently, again, very close. They are now at 23.5% Hispanic, and I know that they are actively working on creating their strategic planning process and making sure that the institution is ready for their next steps as soon as they become HSI eligible and designated. Western Nevada College also became an HSI most recently, and they are at 26% Hispanic. And they have a best practice of a Latino Leadership Academy that has been recognized nationally in 2021 that is showing very promising persistence, retention, and graduation rates of Latinx students. So again, this is a very quick snapshot among all of our institutions. And so looking ahead at what we have in store for ourselves is we would love to bring back a symposium, a meaningful symposium for HSI and MSI in 2022. And it's so nice to be able to think ahead in that fashion at this point. We want to continue the momentum towards improved student success initiatives and keep that momentum going with our partnerships. We particularly want to look at how can we have a data accountability framework. One of the things, and I hope you noted with throughout the slides, each of our institutions are representing how we are performing a little differently. But perhaps if we had a consistent benchmarks that we could all kind of measure up to across the system. So we are exploring a partnership with Excellencia in Education that's already a research firm that can provide those benchmarks. We want to also continue the pursuit of federal funding opportunities, as we always do. In fact, in the spring, there'll be another round of certain federal grants. And finally, we want to see our students, our ENSHE students, participating more in leadership and development internship opportunities, which we already are increasing the number of our students. Even last, in October, frankly, we had a record number of our ENSHE students participating in the annual conference for HAKU, which is great. We've got to get our students out on this national platform. So at this time, this concludes my presentation, and I really do want to thank you for your time, and I'm willing to address any questions you may have.
Thank you, VP Cota. Any questions from the committee? Chancellor Rose.
Sorry, Chair, after the committee members have asked their questions, I'm happy to defer.
I didn't see. Go ahead, Regent.
No question, but just I can't say or be strong enough to go to the HAKU conference. I think it was one of the better conferences that I've attended in the last 4 or 5 years, and I think actually we were at the same one. Yeah. So if anybody is looking for a conference to attend, this was a really good conference, and it's a great organization.
Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Carter. They are very valuable, and we would love to see many of you there.
Thank you, Chairwoman. For the record, Chancellor Rose, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing this information. On an early slide, you mentioned grant writing, and it causes me to ask about our capacity to provide pre- and post-grant support. You know, obviously, our larger institutions have offices of research and larger staffs for that support effort, and I would assume our smaller institutions do not or don't have a tremendous amount of capacity. And so one of the things that I've been talking to my cabinet about and would love to get your on-the-ground perspective is whether we need to be thinking collectively about creating the capacity to go after larger national sources of support.
because it takes a lot of work and effort to apply for these opportunities. Some of them come to us automatically and others are competitive. And so I just wonder if you could share with us your perspective about whether we are staffed appropriately to bring in more federal support for these vital initiatives.
Yes, thank you for that, Chancellor Rose. Every year we prepare our talking points when we have an opportunity to speak to our congressional delegates. And I can tell you that every year that very point is made. When I say that we are as emerging or newly HSIs in a world where HSI may have been around for 30 years in other states, that is exactly where sometimes we are at a disadvantage. Our strength has come, frankly, from uniting together to at least help us, but I will agree that every time we make the pitch, it is about how can we find a way to increase our ability and our capacity to be more competitive, help our other smaller institutions that may not have the budget to be able to invest in an external grant writer or learn from other institutions or build that capacity. So that question is always asked and resources are always asked for or a way that we can get there. So we welcome that conversation to explore how we can increase it.
Great question. Thank you. Any?
Thank you, Chair Perkins. For the record, Constance Brooks, Vice Chancellor of Public Affairs and Advancement. And Chancellor Rose, I just wanted to thank you for that question. About 2 weeks ago, I had the wonderful opportunity to tour seven of our campuses with our federal lobbyists to learn more about our federal priorities, as well as the capacity that we have to be aggressive about our federal pursuits for funding. And one of the resounding themes that emerged from those visits, actually it was something we already understood, but really we, with our federal lobbyists, discussed around grant writing, perhaps the need for a centralized effort within the system office. Mm-hmm. And so that's not something that the cabinet has deliberated or that we've discussed, but it may be something worthy to consider within the strategic planning effort that we have, because obviously our grant capacity would be significant in terms of positioning us for federal or for aggressively pursuing those federal grant opportunities mm-hmm. within the HSI task force, but also within other areas of the system. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that. Great comment.
Thank you for that. And I believe that we could also work with other systems to see how they also build their capacity, for examples.
And if there are no further questions, thank you, VP Cota.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
That takes us up to bylaw and handbook revisions, name and duties of the Cultural Diversity Committee for possible action. And who's presenting? I was scanning through. This has been a long time coming. I think we've been working on this name and change for a while, over a year, I think. And so it's finally come to fruition. So if I could take a motion. Yes, second. Regent Moran.
Yes, I can go ahead and support the motion for language change. But with that, I would like to just say just a couple things. First, we're all very, very appreciative of your time and effort put forth on that particular initiative. And I know it takes a lot of time to go through that and make sure that those changes are accurate, and those certainly are. So I wanted to say I appreciate your time and effort on that and your collaboration with the others on the team and working in sync, obviously, with the Chancellor's office and her cabinet and the others that assisted you in fabricating those changes that were recommended on prior occasions. So appreciate your time and effort on that. That's very important, and I'm glad that we're looking at things very, very closely.
Well, thank you. Is that a motion?
That's a motion. That is a motion. Is there a second is what's more important.
Second.
I heard a second, but it sounded like omnipotent. Okay.
Second.
Regent Arzgata, was that the second? Okay. It just sounded omnipotent. It just sounded like it came from the sky. But thank you. So we have a motion on the floor from Regent Moran, a second from Regent Arzgata. Is there any discussion or questions? Regent Carvalho.
Thank you. Would it be appropriate, Chair Perkins, if we asked the edict committee, we anticipated now going to be the idea council, I guess you could call it. I hate to spring this on them, but I was wondering if they have any comment on this name change and review of our policy. I see a thumbs up over there.
Absolutely.
All right. I love seeing the thumbs up. Okay.
Absolutely. It's appropriate.
Thank you.
But I'm going to put Dr. Payson on the spot because she was the one who came up with idea being forward thinking and best practice.
Yeah, I guess just in explanation, I think it was over a year ago at the Cultural Diversity Committee where Chair Perkins asked if there were ideas for names. And so just knowing what's practiced in a lot of different areas, a lot of different higher education institutions have gone with this acronym. A lot of professional associations for academic disciplines has also gone with the idea name. National Communication Association, which is the association that I'm a part of, that's where I heard the name first, actually, was through that. And I think really key, especially for stakeholders at my own campus, as we were talking about this, ensuring that we added the access piece to that overall idea. We're pretty comfortable with diversity in terms of those demographic categories, pretty comfortable in terms of inclusion, or at least in terms of an idea that we're getting people in and participating. But it's that access piece that gets overlooked. And access can be thought of in a lot of different ways. But in terms of higher education, ensuring that people are able to even get to our campuses, to the table, and to understand and learn in different ways, the access piece was important. So again, I think this change is in the direction that most higher education areas are going in.
Thank you. And state your name and spell your last name for the record.
Jose Melendrez, Melendrez. I am the current chair for EDIC, representing UNLV, and I just wanted to come up here and publicly state that EDIC is 100% behind this and supports the name change and looks forward to working with the regents and the new idea to make sure that we move forward given the dynamics of Nevada and the diversity and equity that exists across our state and each of our institutions. So thank you.
Thank you so much. And with that, any further comments? Okay, I'll call for the vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? That passes unanimously. Thank you, thank you, thank you all for all this hard work. And the next, I know, I feel like there should be applause because it's been a year. Thank you, K-team. Next is the Inchi Land Acknowledgement, which came out of the allyship that Dr. Cosgrove spoke of earlier, just sitting in the back of the room and listening. This is one of the that came boiled to the top for us as a institution and us as the Great Eight should be looking and doing and focusing on. So thank you.
Good morning, and thank you again. For the record, Jose Melendrez, Executive Director for the Office of Community Partnerships in the UNLV School of Public Health, and currently serving on behalf of UNLV and all of our institutions as Chair for the EDIC Council. So today we are very excited to bring this forward and work with our regents to see what we can put in place. I know that several of the institutions have their own specific land acknowledgement given to their geographic area. And also for the record, I invited one of our Native American leaders here in our community that works with us. I'd like to just quickly introduce her. She'll be running through the actual PowerPoint, but I'll just quickly. Dr. Natalie O'Neill is a member of the Fort Peck, Assiniboine, Boyne, and Sioux Tribes of Montana. She is a founding member of the Indigenous Educators Empowerment Organization here in Southern Nevada, actually of the entire state of Nevada, and member of the Nevada Minority Health and Equity Coalition Advisory Council. So just quickly, a land acknowledgement recognizes and respects the relationship that exists between Indigenous peoples and their ancestral and contemporary territories. As we know, there are 27 recognized tribes in the state of Nevada, and both rural and urban tribes that exist. Each of our institutions sits on their respective lands, and so honoring their history, honoring their part in this country, it is critical that we do our part to recognize that, to acknowledge that, and to support those communities as we continue to move forward in the state of Nevada. Again, additionally, land acknowledgments provide us with the opportunity to explore the impacts of colonization and systems of oppression on indigenous peoples. Land acknowledgments do not exist in historical context or past tense. It is vital to understand the longstanding history brought to reside on the lands and to seek to understand place within that history. So with that, I will turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Nellie O'Neill.
Thank you for that, Dr. Melendres. Ambawashte, Daye Wachignaga, Wadopana Ze Macha, Shaze Mitawa, Inkmusnawia, Je Magyabi. Good day. My name is Natalie O'Neill. I am a member of the Nakota Tribes of Montana, but I have called Las Vegas home for years now. I wanted to just start with introducing myself in a traditional way, which is in my Nakota language. There are, like Dr. Melendres said, 27 sovereign nations here, so I was asked and invited to come forward and speak to you guys today, so I thank you for that, and I honor you guys for your time and my time here as well. So just wanted to start with our presentation on briefly an overview of what is land acknowledgement, and then kind of how do you do that, right? How do you broach that? I feel like in this community and in our Southern Nevada region, many people are very open to that, but like, where do we start, right? So we don't want to offend anyone. We don't want to do things in not in a good way. And I think we'll start with, you know, kind of what is land acknowledgement? Well, first one is you want to make this something that is, don't make a land statement without also taking serious steps to create visibility and space for Indigenous people in the setting you're making the statement in, right? So to do it kind of superficially, you want to really reflect on what Indigenous people say about your space. And if you don't know, then, and if it's not in, you know, the good way, then think about what it means and take those steps. So I think just taking a moment to pause and reflect on, you know, what that would mean. Even me just, you know, introducing myself in my native language is something that traditionally is done in many, many different settings when you come work with Indigenous people, but may not be something that is done regularly, right, in our academic setting, right? So that's one thing to kind of just take mind of, reflect of what is typically done in settings. You know, it's important to take the steps to know the history of the area you live in. You know, make a personal connection, do some research, right? So be genuine about it if that's the steps that we're taking forward. You know, what stories do you find that you connect with? You know, what are some of the artistic elements found in the culture of the tribal communities around you? I will say, having, you know, been in this space for a while, we have some amazing, right, artistic elements just in the Southern Nevada, Northern Nevada area. What are the special days like and when are they, right? So that's important to also take note of. And then what are the issues that they're currently talking about? So just being aware, right, and being an alert neighbor, you know, that is really important. So just making that personal connection. So when you do something like a land acknowledgement, it's not just something you're rotely reading off of a paper, right? It's something that we really take a moment to reflect because it's current. It's not history. Yes, it's part of history, and I'll talk about why with Nevada in the next slide, but it is someone like myself, you know, we are still here, right? And so increasing visibility is important. So once you, you know, make that space, you look at a map, and I'll show you on the next slide what we're talking about. Reflect on the history of the place you stand in, right? You know, feel your intention about making space for the people you're talking about. And it's okay to speak their names, right? So there is some, we'll talk about, you know, going forward, there's always ways to kind of navigate through that successfully. But really honoring the stewardship that continues today is really important. And just repetition, right? Repeating it every meeting, every major, you know, engagement that's had, especially it is important. And it could be something as simple as what, you know, Dr. Melendres just stated. And it could be more depending on what the you know, occasion calls for. So this is the one that I really was referring to, being as that we are, you guys represent statewide, right? And this is a statewide entity. There are historical, on this map, represented historical homelands of several of our Indigenous peoples for Nevada. But of course, here in southern Nevada, we are in the home of the Nuwu, which is the southern Paiute. But if you look at the little blue dots, I know it's kind of hard to see from the projection, but those are actually our 27 sovereign tribal nations of Nevada, right? And they are still here to this day. And they are occupying a space, and each one of our higher ed institutions are on, you know, or near one of their current lands, right? Our historical lands. So, you know, a simple statement that is here is, you could even just say something as simple as, before beginning, we would take a moment to recognize that here in Nevada, we stand on the land of the Nuwu, because that's where we are today, right? We take a moment to recognize and honor their stewardship that continues today. And with this recognition, we state an intention to rightfully include their voice and respect them as 27 tribal nations of Nevada. That took about, what, maybe 30 seconds, right, depending on how fast you live. So, but if you think about it, it's so much more than that, right? The 30 seconds of words, but the intent and the purpose is so powerful and so valuable, especially for those that come from, you know, an indigenous heritage from, you know, this state and others and beyond, you know. So I believe that's all we had. Anyone, any questions for myself or Dr. Melendez?
Thank you, Dr. O'Neill. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Regent Moran.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, you know, I appreciate your time here before the subcommittee, and it really is interesting. The presentation has allowed me to do a little bit of due diligence, too. It was almost more of a history lesson, and I am fairly into that. But I wanted to just read a couple things into the record that I had come across in some of my readings on this particular topic, and how it ties in specifically to higher education and how we're teaching our students the correct history and how that history is characterized. There's a professor at a college and a fairly well-known author. His name is James H. Merrill, and he's written extensively on these issues involving students and how we teach students in education. I wanted to read two quotes from him, and then I want to read just one other thing into the record as well. I'm sure you probably know a lot of this stuff, but for my colleagues and others that are listening in, James Merrill goes on to say the real reason we have a ways to go in understanding, in parentheses, American Indians, has little to do with how deftly or clumsily indigenous peoples have been stitched into the American tapestry. The root of the problem lies in the very words used to tell stories about olden times. He goes on to state, words have real effects for Native peoples and for the course of future American history. They were and are tools in the imperial project of relieving American Indians of their sovereignty and their land. The article goes on to speak, and I'll be quick, this is going to wrap up here in a minute. The words we choose to write and say have great meaning and power, as we all know. Whether it is politics or the media or the words exchanged between a parent and a child, words are fraught with meaning and importance. The words we use day in and day out convey messages to others. The classroom is no different, where what we teach and say to our students about the past and present is absorbed by our students and infiltrates their particular vocabularies. And this is where historians have a particular problem. We perpetuate fictions and stereotypes in the language that we use to talk about indigenous Americans and to describe their histories and cultures. In fact, our words, such as the natives, Indians, tribes, bands, wilderness, these are not my words, these are their words, and I'm sure you've heard these before, hunters, nomads, and so on and so forth, they all have consequences, no matter how unintended, because, again, our words become our students' own. And so I appreciate you integrating this and continuing to integrate a correct history, a correct characterization of a long history into our system of higher education. It will, I'm sure, filter down into K through 12 as well at some point in time, and it probably is already, but I wanted to make those statements, Madam Chair, because this is a very important item. It's a very important issue, and it's remains very, very strong in my heart. And so, again, I appreciate what you all are out there doing in creating the history, the correct and accurate history. I look forward to more in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll take that as the motion to develop an INCHI blank statement for all institutions to use or not to use. I just wanted to have a unified statement about the land acknowledgement, and so that, you know, if you didn't know about it, and it can be read at each, it can be posted on our website, it can be linked, just so it's like a unified statement from all of us at INCHI. So that's your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I will for sure make a motion to acknowledge that particular statement.
Thank
as
you.
Characterized in the agenda item.
Thank
I'll
you.
Second that motion, but I am not going to ask you to repeat it. That was wonderful. Well stated.
Very well stated. Thank you, Regent Arascada. Are there any questions? Go ahead, Vice Chair.
Regent Perkins, Chair Perkins. Are you in this motion? Are you saying this is going to be? It's going to be from the board, right? The statement's going to be from the board. A unified statement, right? Or is it?
Yes and no. Yes, it's going to be from the board, but it's going to be inspired by the edict committee. They're the resident experts on the land acknowledgement. But just for us to be unified and to have one bold statement that all of us can get behind.
Oh, I agree with the concept. I just want to make sure when the edict committee works with whoever they're working with to craft that statement from the eight institutions, then it comes back to the full board, and that becomes a board statement to then put on the website, et cetera, right?
Absolutely. Very
Thank
well put.
You
Thank
for
you.
The clarification.
Regent, I'm sorry. Chancellor Rose.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, Chancellor Rose, I also have just a clarifying question about the motion, because it is my understanding that we have institutions that have already developed their own land acknowledgement statement, and I would hate to do anything that would undermine the work that was done collaboratively on the campuses to come to those statements. So again, just for my own edification, I may be the only one confused on this point, but just want to make sure that, again, that the motion is about a board statement that would be used for board meetings and on our website, rather than supplanting those that had already been developed.
Absolutely. I don't want to, same sentiment. We need a board statement, and of course the institutions are welcome to use that statement if they choose to, but no, not to take over or supplant.
Yeah, no, just quickly, Chair Perkins. Yes, Chancellor, that is correct. We are very mindful and respectful that each of the institutions have their respective land acknowledgements, as should be, based on the geographic area where that they represent. The statement that we presented to you all today is definitely for the Board of Regents to consider and support, because, again, as it representing the entire state of Nevada, that's the language that we presented that for your all's consideration. We can obviously play with that a little bit more and offer something more in-depth for the Board of Regents to use that would represent the Nevada system of higher education, being mindful and respectful of that each of the institutions do have their specific land acknowledgments.
Thank you. Thank you for answering that.
Madam Chair, this is Yvonne Navarez-Goodson down up in Reno, if I may.
Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. For the record, Yvonne Navarez-Goodson, Deputy General Counsel. I just wanted to offer a clarification with respect to this agenda item. It's my understanding that the materials presented do provide a statement for the committee to recommend to the full board for communications that would be utilized by the board or official INCHI activities, separate and distinct from what institutions might do. So as I understood Regent Moran's motion, it was to adopt the particular statement that had been presented in the materials to you. Is that your understanding of the motion, or would you like to bring this back to the committee with a future proposed statement for formal adoption?
Regent Moran.
No, I think we're okay with the motion as is. I think we can go ahead and vote on the acknowledgement as is and as proposed and as agendized. I think it sits properly.
And the seconder agrees? Awesome. Thank you. And thank you for that clarification. And okay. And with that, I'll call for a vote. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. That motion carries.
Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you both. And let's see, number 8, NCHI Summit Highlights, Southern Nevada Diversity Summit, the Student Leadership Summit, the UNLV Minority Serving Institutions Student Success Summit, for information only. And Dr. Brooks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Constance Brooks, Vice Chancellor for Public Affairs and Advancement. And I have the pleasure to provide you with a summary of 3 wonderful convenings that were held during this very trying semester of competing demands. These were wonderful opportunities for us all to gather, to grow, to learn together, to experience professional development, and I would say personally, to receive some inspiration around the work that we're all engaged in during these trying times. And so with that, I'd like to start with providing a summary of the UNLV MSI Success Summit, which was held on September 24th. I had the pleasure of attending with Chancellor Rose and also with Regent McAdoo, and we enjoyed, and I believe that you, Regent Perkins, were participating virtually, and so we're grateful for your participation. The MSI Summit had approximately 200 faculty and roughly 60 students to attend through a hybrid convening virtually and in person. The theme was student success, and we were wowed by the featured speaker, Dr. Kathy Davidson, founder of Future Initiatives at the City of University of New York and the author of The New Education, which we all received as participants within the summit, and it was such a great gift. I am enjoying the book whenever I have a moment to read it, which is not often. However, the breakout sessions featured topics around design, an equity-minded syllabus development, engaging diversity and research across the higher education career spectrum, and empowering students and expanding access. Major takeaways for some of the participants, including myself, include essentially that students in the modern minority-serving institution are not the students of 50 or even 20 years ago. To truly serve our students requires us to think differently and to bring students to the table and to lead boldly. And if I could quote our chancellor, it's really an opportunity for us to think about how our campuses can become more student ready and a little less focused on trying to get our students campus ready, right? Really shifting that paradigm and making certain that we are fully serving our students and equipping them to do their best. I'm going to be remiss if I didn't highlight the lead staff that were engaged in this effort. Dr. Laurel Pritchard and Dr. Juanita Fain and their teams were outstanding and really put together a very incredible conference. The second summit that I'd like to present to you is the Southern Nevada Diversity Summit, now going strong for over a decade. This day-long collaboratively planned interinstitutional event offers sessions related to diversity and inclusion, student success initiatives, workforce and economic development, community engagement, with the overarching goal of improving pipelines to higher education. This year's conference was hosted by Nevada State College, and they did such a remarkable job with a completely virtual conference, but still making sure that each participant felt as though that they were engaged and that they were part of the program. This effort was led by NSC's Interim Director of Community, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, Ms. Amy Evaluna, who worked throughout the days and nights trying to pull this off, and she was quite successful with a very talented and hardworking team. The participants were welcomed by Regent Perkins. Thank you for offering the welcome. And also want to thank you for your support of the diversity summits and for participating as well. Also, Regent Geddes, thank you for participating. I know that you are a consistent participant in the diversity summit, so thank you. And thank you to all the regents that had the opportunity to join. There were over 800 individuals who registered for the conference and participated, representing academic faculty, administrative faculty, classified staff, employers and employees, and student leaders, and also K-12 educators and community members from throughout the state. A key takeaway from this year's summit, obtained in the attendee post-event survey, is that many individuals felt more able and more comfortable to participate in a virtual conference versus an in-person event. And so really one of those areas of growth and opportunity where we've learned to adjust and pivot and maybe realize how innovation and technology can really help us to do our work much better, smarter, faster, and more efficient and make people feel comfortable to engage. And then lastly, the more recent summit that we enjoyed was the INCHI Fall Student Leadership Summit. That was an incredible convening just held on November 20th, and this was targeting all INCHI students system-wide. We had over 300 students registered. The summit theme this year was student leadership, and it featured topics geared toward empowering women identified and non-binary students. Lead staff were Dr. Edith Fernandez, NSC Division of College and Community Engagement, and Heather Ricarlo, who is WNC Coordinator for Student Life. And also we wanted to thank our featured speaker, who was Nevada State President, Dr. Darian Pollard, who is we're gracious and grateful to hear the kind words and encouragement that you provided. We also want to thank Vice Chair Pro Tem Carvalho for the welcome and for your participation. There were 18 breakout sessions within this summit. Some of the topics included first-gen leadership for women, crisis leadership, leading in a pandemic, how to negotiate your salary, create and build your personal brand. And then major takeaways included the inclusion of women identifying and non-binary students and presenters was bold and long overdue and necessary. These were responses from participants. Some of them also stated that we have amazing talent of all ranks and titles, from academic and administrative faculty as well as classified employees. And the next summit date will be spring of 22. And so again, I just wanna thank all of the staff leads who were responsible for pulling off these successful conferences. And I really understand the meaningful work and the tireless hours and days that were put into this, because we all benefited from these sources of collaboration and inspiration. And so with that, I will close and offer myself for any questions.
Are there any questions from the committee? Regent Moran.
Yes, Madam Chair, I know the item is on just for information, but I just wanted to, again, you know, we don't get a chance to recognize all of the Chancellor's Cabinet members, but in the last couple of months, I've had an opportunity to speak with all of the Chancellor's Cabinet members independently and individually. And I've got to say, Constance, I don't know how you are able to do all of the things that you do. This particular item, as well, it just shows the further dedication and time commitment, and appreciate the professionalism and the hard work. And this is great. Again, I don't know how you have any, regular family life, but keep
don't
up
ask
the good
them.
Work. That's why you get paid the big bucks. But anyway, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Regent Moran. And I just want to thank the board for their example and their leadership and the dedication that they provide. It cascades down throughout our organization. And so I'm just grateful for your example. Thank you.
Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I maybe haven't caught up with the times or something, but what exactly does it mean, women identifying? What does that mean? I never see men identifying. What is women identifying? Who identifies these women? Or what is it? What does it mean?
Well, thank you, Regent Boylan, for the question. This is Constance Brooks for the record. That's a very interesting question and a good question. And I want to also just acknowledge your courage for asking that question. I think sometimes people feel a little intimidated about maybe what they don't know with regard to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so really, in terms of identity, that is something that is subjective and that people can select on their own. And so we wanted to make certain that this conference included that particular population, because there were some breakout sessions and targeted information that would help that particular population.
Who is that particular population? That's what I'm trying to ask. Who is
sure.
That?
Those would be individuals that self-identify as women.
Self-identify.
So they may not have been born biologically as a woman, but maybe they self-identify as a woman. And so we wanted
to
make sure.
I see. Okay.
Yes.
I get it now.
Yes.
Thank you so much. I was quite confused.
That's okay.
But I do have another question. Excuse me. And I think this is going to irritate. And again, if you're talking about courage, I have none. My fear is my greatest courage, actually. I keep hearing this term, especially yesterday and today, minority serving institutions. Do they not serve anybody else, only the minorities? Or do other institutions not serve minorities? Why do we have this? I've heard this, and you brought it up very nicely, and sure, especially in this seminar, this thing. So I'm really confused when we say this is, why aren't we serving everybody? All students, to me, are students. I don't care what you know, color, religion, race, breed, what minority. So what does that mean? So there are institutions that don't serve minorities?
Oh, no, sir. I'm sorry, excuse me. Thank you, Regent Boylan, for the question. And again, this is Constance Brooks from The Record. And that is not what it means. It simply means, first of all, it's a federal designation. And what it recognizes is that there are groups of underserved populations of students that require additional supports financially, as well as advising and other services that are provided on campuses. And so federally, there's a recognition, and we're certainly grateful for that. And so what that does is when an institution reaches a certain threshold population-wise, UNLV is a perfect example of that, being one of the most diverse student populations in the nation. They are perfectly situated for a lot of federal funding opportunities, and having that sort of name brand designation offers them, especially to our federal delegation who will lobby on our behalf and are aggressively pursuing federal funding, this gives them a little bit more of a cachet, I would say, with that name brand of MSI that really positions us above, I would say, positions us better than other institutions that don't enjoy that designation. And I know that the University of Nevada, Reno, is aggressively pursuing their HSI as well as MSI designations. It again gives them the opportunity for federal funding, and I know that they're very, very close and have a lot of interventions and initiatives in place to support that.
How interesting. Thank you so much. So we're doing it all for the money, right? To get more money.
Well, I focused on the money, but I'd be remiss if I didn't say that it's really about student success. And what the funding provides us is more opportunities and more resources to support student success.
Yes, ma'am.
That's really what it's all about. And thank you for helping me to clarify that.
Much appreciated.
Thank you so much.
That was a great answer. Chair Dercaller. Chair?
Thank you, Chair Perkins. I'd like to just brag on Western Nevada College. In 2014, they put together a Latino cohort because there was such a huge gap between the Latino students' graduation rates and a white student's graduation rate, because that's really what all the measurement's against. So over the course of the last 7 years, they have not only closed the achievement gap, but those students in the Latino cohort at Western Nevada College, and President Solis, please tell me if I'm saying anything wrong, but they not only have closed the gap, but their graduation rates are higher now than, say, a white student. And with the federal designation, it allows the institution to apply for grants for, it could be more advising. These students are coming from homes where, you know, usually a second language, you know, Spanish is spoken in the home. Maybe the parents, all the things. I mean, they just haven't had the advantages. But research has shown that if you put the emphasis and give them the support they need, which is what the cohort did, they can compete and surpass. So I think it's a wonderful thing that the federal government has recognized. We're trying to get equity in the United States. That's what this is all about.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for that, and very good explanation, Dr. Brooks. Equity.
Thank you.
That's exactly what we're talking about, is equity. Thank you for that question. Was there any further questions from the board? And I want to echo what Regent Moran said. Thank you, all these summits. Every time I go to one, I learn something new. They elevate my thought process and have me think along different lines, and I'm sure it does it for everybody who was involved. And I appreciate the hard work that was put in producing these.
And that takes us to, once again, Dr. Brooks for the Nash Equity Collaborative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Constance Brooks for the record, Vice Chancellor of Public Affairs and Advancement. And actually, my partner, Deputy General Counsel Yvonne Navarez-Goodson, is going to start this summary update, and I'm going to supplement as necessary. Thank you.
Thank you, Constance, and thank you, Chair Perkins. For the record, Yvonne Navarez-Goodson, Deputy General Counsel. Being respectful of the committee's time and the board's time, I'll be brief here, but I wanted to thank Chair Perkins for elevating this conversation to this committee. You might be familiar from the conversation yesterday from the Chancellor's report about the work that we're doing as a system with the NASH organization, the National Association of System Heads. And one aspect of that work that we're doing is in respect to the NASH Equity Collaborative. And that particular organization has brought together various systems to engage in equity work through a framework that they've developed about best practices. And so while we've brought this topic before you multiple times, you'll remember or hopefully recall that the equity practice that we are focused on and the Chancellor is engaging in is the work around closing the achievement gap and hoping to create a more diverse faculty and staff through our equity lens. And so that particular equity practice has partnered us with the University of Southern Illinois and Washington State Systems while we navigate this work. I would be remiss if I did not offer for the committee's review the members of the NC team that have so graciously volunteered their time to participate in this particular work at the Chancellor's request, and certainly it's been my pleasure to work with them and learn from them every day. From UNR, it's Dr. Eloisa Gordon-Mora. From UNLV, Dr. Juanita Fain. From Truckee Meadows Community College, Yvonne Allen. From the College of Southern Nevada, both Lawrence Weekly and Clarissa Cota. From Nevada State College, Dr. Edith Fernandez. From Western Nevada College, Angela Holt. Great Basin College, Evie Buell, and Desert Research Institute, Dana Trimble. With that, Madam Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions, but for purposes of a summary, we are currently navigating this NASH Equity Collaborative with our partner systems. Because it's a work in progress, I hope to have many updates for you as we navigate this work, but at this point in time, we're really focused on the data that NSHE has both at the system and at the institution level in terms of where we stand between the diversity of our student population and that of our faculty and staff. And also we're looking at learning best practices in terms of how we are recruiting for those positions and ensuring that equity lens with through our recruitment, but also retention. And the hope is that we will bring back to not only this committee, but also the full board with the Chancellor's support best practices where we might see system-wide engagement to move the needle in terms of closing that achievement gap. And with that, Madam Chair, I would turn it over to any questions or to Dr. Brooks if she has anything she would like to add.
Dr. Brooks? Yes, thank you. Thank you, Constance Brooks, for the record, and thank you, Deputy General Counsel Yvonne Navarez-Goodson, for your summary. The only thing I wanted to add was that we had a September meeting with the NASH Collaborative, and a few of the takeaways that I thought were significant from our collaborative partners with the University of Washington system and the Southern Illinois University system, which happens to be my undergrad alma mater. So very excited to be engaged in this work, also helping my alma mater, which is great. But really some of the takeaways we learned from them were they're focusing on understanding the need, using data to define where they are in their process. They are interested in training for search committees, looking at how our search committees can influence the work around tenure promotion, hiring, recruitment. Also looking at the impact assessment toolkit that could be developed that search committees could utilize in specific training. Also looking at establishing equity advocates and champions around the campus in different departments as well as academic areas. Also in creating an equity checklist for search committees as they are considering candidates, looking to help them to mitigate bias and really ensure that there is some consistency around the decision-making process. And then lastly, I'd be remiss if I didn't thank our presidents for their commitment and steadfast leadership in this area. Both Yvonne and I presented to the Council of Presidents last month, and enjoyed a robust discussion with all eight of our presidents, all of the great eight, and really enjoyed hearing their perspectives around culture and the need for interventions and change around culture in this arena. Also looking at interventions around hiring practices and retention. And I know that that President Whitfield has extensive experience in diversifying the professoriate, and so we're looking to glean from his expertise as well as our other presidents. And I just want to really emphasize that leadership buy-in is the key to this huge culture shift, and I want to acknowledge that our presidents are fully on board, and we appreciate them being engaged. Thank you.
Are there any questions from the board? Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm looking forward to hearing more from NASH in future meetings. And that brings us to new business. Any of the committee members have any new business? I think from some of our comments, explore benchmarks for HSIs and MSIs and the pre-grant and post-grant support. So sometime we might be able to cover that on a future agenda. Regent Moran.
Yes, Madam Chair, I just can't help myself. I was going to say, in response to the earlier items that we discussed with Regent Boylan, if we could be notified of an upcoming workshop, I could use some, as far as equity, inclusion, NASH, and how that's integrated, you know, on a national basis. If there was something that was upcoming that we could go to, I'd like to know about it, because that's one thing I haven't really participated in, and it's something that I would like to participate in. So maybe, down the road, one of the next agendas after the first of the year, maybe we can get kind of possible conferences that would, focus in on this particular subject, because, again, I could use some polishing up myself, and it's an interesting topic, and all ties into student success at the end of the day, and that's really kind of the idea. So if we can get that information, that's the only new business that I could think of, Madam Chair, but thank you for the time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any further new business? See, okay, and that takes us to public comment. Is there any public comment in ELCO?
There is no public comment in ELCO at this time.
Thank you. Any public comment in Reno?
There's none at this time.
Any public comment in Las Vegas, either video, written, or in person? And thank you all. I apologize for running over. We had a lively discussion, and I appreciate all the input. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.